The Guardian. On paper, the Japanese anesthesiologist Yoshitaka Fuji was a dazzling example of scientific productivity. Over two decades, he held posts at five institutions, associate positions at two more, and published more than 200 papers. In some years, he published a dozen randomised controlled trials. In fact, his superhuman publication record was starting to arouse suspicions among colleagues. But it was only when a British doctor began scouring through the statistics in his papers that the phenomenal scale of Fuji's scientific fraud became clear. In 2012, an inquiry by the Japanese Society of Anesthesiologists concluded that he had fabricated a total of 172 papers over the past 19 years, making him, by numbers, the biggest scientific fraud in recorded history. In many cases, they found no records of patients and no evidence medication was ever administered. In their report, they wrote, "It is as if someone sat at a desk and wrote a novel about a research idea." This week, we look at the statistical vigilantes who are scouring datasets to identify cases of fraud and poor scientific practice.
Well, I've been working in this area for donkey's years, and people say, you know, well, why do people find statistics so unintuitive and difficult? And I finally, after 40 years, decided that it's because they really are unintuitive and difficult.
When one calculates that statistic for age, height, weights, and so on, it all accumulates into a very unlikely distribution.
Maybe it is also a human bias that we only sort of double check our results if they're not in line with what we expected in the first place. So if you really expect to find something, it could be the case that you're less likely to double check your results.
I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
Hi.
Hello, we made it.
Before we get onto the case of Fuji and the doctor who raised the alarm, I wanted to get a bit of background.
Well, yes, I think it was.
This is David Spiegelhalter.
I'm the Winton Professor for the Public Understanding of Risk at the University of Cambridge, and I'm also president of the Royal Statistical Society.
Producer Max spoke to David and started by asking him about the crucial role of statistics in the scientific method.
It's extremely important, and for two reasons, I think, which is not generally recognized. One is that statistics are needed to estimate or to communicate the magnitude of something. What is the temperature of the ocean? You know, what is the estimated benefit of this drug, and so on. So, you know, actual quantities, you know, scientific quantities, measurements. Fine. But there's the other absolutely vital role, which is to measure the strength of evidence for discoveries. And this is this whole area of p-values and significance and all this issue. And both those roles are incredibly important. They're related, but they actually can be handled differently to some extent. So, for example, in terms of we might be interested in the strength of evidence that the temperature of the ocean is increasing, or the drug is not on average beneficial. And others discussing about what's called hypotheses rather than just quantities.
Lovely. And then following that, why is there so much room when it comes to statistics for things to go wrong, whether knowingly or not?
Well, I've been working in this area for donkey's years, and people say, you know, well, why do people find statistics so unintuitive and difficult? And I finally, after 40 years, decided that it's because they really are unintuitive and difficult. This is not easy. You know, statistical inference, descriptive statistics is okay, and that's absolutely vital, and data visualizations and all those tools for looking at data are absolutely crucial. But when it comes to statistical inference, and in particular this aspect of deciding the strength of evidence for hypotheses, this is not easy. The statistics are complex. They're often, they're collected in a complex way, often large numbers of individuals, large number of things measured on individuals, and then deciding the hypothesis, deciding even what the hypotheses are and investigating them and claiming about the strength of evidence is extremely difficult. That's the first thing. So there's lots of room for things to go wrong. The crucial thing is, as you said, is knowingly or not. you know, of course, there's deliberate fraud. People can make up the numbers, and that's quite difficult to detect, but you know, people try, and there's lots of retractions based on this kind of thing, like just like people distort images as well. I actually think that there's a much more important thing, which is, you could call it incompetence, you know, which is just mistakes in what's being done. But there's also this idea, you know, what's become known in psychology as questionable research practices. The fact that people, whether, you know, not maliciously, but or not even greatly incompetently, but just endlessly during a complex series of experiments and reporting them in particular, tweak what's going on. Little twiddles here and there, always to make things look bigger and better and more important than perhaps they really are. The classic one, of course, is changing your hypothesis halfway through an experiment, deciding, well, actually, I wasn't really interested in this outcome. Now this outcome looks much better. This is one that should look cool. Let's focus on that one when we report. Well, that is, you could call that malpractice. It's very natural, and many people admit to doing it for the best possible reasons. Well, because that's what's interesting there, so they do it. Not perhaps realizing just the potential there for distorting and exaggerating results. There are these lovely phrases like researcher degrees of freedom that's used, or the garden of forking paths is one of my favorites as well, just to describe all these endless little choices that are not reported and they're not predetermined, but can end up exaggerating the results.
Flawed statistics may not be immediately obvious when you read the headline findings of a study. But when results have been manipulated or biased, clues can be left behind.
Hi, Max. Can you hear me?
This is John Carlisle.
I am a consultant, anaesthetist and intensivist at Torbay Hospital. I'm not employed by a university and I work for the NHS.
John spoke to producer Max via Skype and started by explaining what prompted him to investigate the studies of Yoshitaka Fuji.
I had been aware that there'd been some doubts and suspicions raised about Fuji's work. So I was wondering, why hasn't an investigation happened for Fuji's work? So I wrote a letter, which was in 2010, to anaesthesia saying, how about getting together a group to look at Fuji's data to either confirm or refute the suspicions that had been raised? And he emailed me back saying, okay, good letter, thanks for that. We're not going to publish it for the time being. We'd like you maybe to put some work yourself into this to just let us know what you've got. So I started looking at how can I look at the papers by Fuji to determine or help determine whether these data be made up. So you can look at results. The problem with the results is you don't really know. And this is why you do the experiment. You don't know whether what sort of effect the intervention is going to have. And it can have an effect on any of the results. So if you find a rather unusual set of results, it might just be because the interventions had a different effect to the one you thought it might do. So the only part of a randomized controlled trial that you know the characteristics of are those characteristics that are present before you do anything. So in a study where you're allocating patients to one group or another, there are some characteristics of those patients that are present before you do anything. For instance, simply height, weight, age, those sorts of characteristics that you're going to measure before you actually do anything.
It was by applying a statistical model to these so-called baseline variables, the stuff in a scientific paper that no one's normally interested in, that John was able to uncover some uncomfortable truths.
The model I used just assumes that if you had a population of people, you randomly selected them into two or more groups, and thereby the range of heights and weights in the various groups you allocated those patients to would correspond with a random distribution, which has got certain characteristics. So what I did was look at his papers and see what mean average values he had reported and the variability of those values, usually reported as a standard deviation. What was characteristic of Yoshitaka Fuji's data were the mean values were very similar. For instance, 72 kilograms and 73 kilograms when the variability of measurements in each of the two groups was quite substantial. So it would be unlikely to, for one to see such similar mean values. And when one calculates that statistic for age, height, weights, and so on, it all accumulates into a very unlikely distribution.
John's investigation made him question just how widespread fraud and statistical malpractice is in his field. After this short break, we'll hear how he applied similar methods to over 5,000 randomised controlled trials.
And at a guess, 5 to 10% of the disparity is because something's wrong with the data.
We'll also hear from other researchers using high-tech methods to fight back against flawed statistics.
In a nutshell, StatCheck basically is sort of a spell checker for your statistics.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin.
As a reminder, we've got a situation where...
Before the break, we heard from the president of the Royal Statistical Society, David Spiegelhalter, about how poor statistical practices, whether intentional or otherwise, can come about. We also heard from consultant anaesthetist John Carlyle, whose investigation helped uncover one of the most egregious cases of scientific fraud on record.
Given that we've got 3 out of 20 authors in this top 20 list, or maybe we don't lie any more than other people.
Next, John decided to apply the same techniques to his field as a whole.
I thought, well, why don't we look at authors who've published in non-anaesthetic journals, non-specialist ones, and why don't we, rather than pursue people we are suspicious about, why don't we just look at all the randomised controlled trials published over a period in anaesthetic and non-anaesthetic journals. So that's what I did. And I started doing that before that paper was published in 2012. So it took me the next 4.5 years to go through just over 5,000 randomised controlled trials that were published in 6 anaesthetic journals, and perhaps, in a way, more importantly, in 2 non-anaesthetic journals. And I was interested to see whether the baseline data that I'd analysed for Fuji had a similar rate of unusual patterns in anaesthetic journals as they did in non-anaesthetic. So I was comparing, on the one hand, I was comparing journals with other journals, and I was also comparing within that survey of 5,000 randomised controlled trials, those that had been retracted versus those that had not, to see if there are any differences in baseline data in those sort of two categories of papers. The two findings were three findings. Firstly, the model didn't agree with the observed data, so something was unexpected. Secondly, that abnormal distribution was similar in all those journals I looked at, the 8 journals, 6 anaesthetic and 2 non-anaesthetic. But thirdly, the data in retracted papers was different to papers that had not been retracted. So those are the three main findings. So in summary, I think that maybe 80, 90% of the difference between the observed and the expected data distribution is down to the model being wrong. And at a guess, 5 to 10% of the disparity is because something's wrong with the data. So things that are wrong with the data might be just honest error. So people have just written 47 instead of 57 and it gets published. And then we move on to maybe people intentionally making errors or basically making data up. So, and obviously that's the most interesting, exciting part of it, because what we don't want is to be working on research that's been made up. And also we don't want to be working with research that isn't made up, but in which there's been lots of errors made when writing it up. So those are the two bits of research that we really don't want to be working with, because it can lead to us using the wrong treatments for patients.
John has effectively become a statistical guardian for his own field, but this has meant him carrying out huge amounts of work in his own time. Is there a way that these kinds of checks could be automated, though?
Hi there.
This is Michelle Nuyten.
My name is Michelle Nuyten, and I'm a PhD student at Tilburg University in the Meta Research Center there.
Michelle was one of the scientists behind a software package called StatCheck. I spoke with her via Skype this week.
Well, in a nutshell, StatCheck basically is sort of a spell checker for your statistics. And what it does, it checks statistical results for internal consistency.
Okay, and why did you set it up in the first place?
Oh, that's actually, sort of for ourselves. It started out as something to make our own research easier, because I think it was about 5 years ago now that my supervisor was doing some research in which he hand-checked, together with his PhD student at the time, he hand-checked a lot of articles to see if these results were statistically consistent or not, because in one very important article, they found one inconsistent result, and that sort of inspired them to search through the literature to see how common this was. And then another PhD student, actually the other author of StatCheck, Sasha Abscomb, thought, well, this is such an easy procedure, we should automate this. And then he started working on StatCheck, and I came in a little bit later to automate the procedure and to basically just make our own life easier. And only later we thought, well, this is something that people could also use to check their own manuscript.
Okay, and this is in the field of psychology that you're applying it to, is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
Just for people who haven't been following this, that there has been a concern in psychology, hasn't there, about reproducibility and maybe statistics not always being up to standard. Was that part of the motivation as well?
Well, it did, I think, cause all the attention for StatCheck a lot, because as you say, I think for the last 5 years now, I think this whole replicability crisis, as they call it, started in 2011, 2012. There was a large fraud case that busted at the same time as some very weird research got published in which they proved that we could look into the future, and people really started doubting the way that psychological research was being written up and being done. And a lot of things were reevaluated with a lot of scrutiny. Yeah, and people started to get a little bit more critical and a little bit more focused on what had actually been done and the statistics of it. And using StatCheck to make sure that the statistics you report are actually correct is really in line with this sort of heightened level of criticism.
With this in mind, Michelle and her team used StatCheck to assess over 30,000 psychology papers recently. I asked her what they found.
Well, what we found is the first thing is that in roughly half of the papers that contained any statistical results, we found that there was at least one inconsistency. And that sounds very dramatic, but that usually wasn't really the case. It was usually rounding errors in a third decimal somewhere, so not really influential. So what I thought was possibly more worrying is that in 1 out of 8 papers, we found an inconsistency that could potentially have changed the substantive conclusion. So in psychology, we focus a lot on a statistic called the p-value. And a p-value, in a nutshell, this is not entirely statistically correct, but in a nutshell, it's the probability that your result is a coincidence. And in psychology, there's this sort of this magic boundary that if your p-value is lower than 0.05, your result is considered statistically significant, and that is often equated with important. And what we found is that in 1 in 8 papers, one of these p-values was rounded sort of the wrong way. So if we recalculated it, it was above 0.05 and it was reported as below, or the other way around.
So you're talking about things like if it was 0.054 or something like that, and then it would have just been rounded down, or...
So we didn't necessarily find that these p-values were wrongly rounded. What we did find is that in 1 in 8 papers, this p-value that was reported was on the other side of this magical 0.05 boundary than when we recalculated it. So that would change the substantive conclusion of the paper. So the paper would say there is an effect, it is significant, and upon recalculation, we would say, well, it's not, or the other way around. But what is more interesting, perhaps, is that we more often found p-values that were wrongly rounded down, so in favor of finding an effect.
So that suggests that there may be something more than just innocent, little errors creeping in these papers.
That could be, but there could also be several other explanations that might be even more plausible. So there's this large problem in psychology, and I think in almost every scientific field, that's called publication bias. And that states that statistically significant results have a higher probability of ending up in the literature than non-significant results. And if you imagine that these errors that we found were just random, so they were made in every direction the same number of times, but we only publish papers that report something as being significant, then you also end up with this this imbalance that we found in the literature. So it could be due to the publication process. Another explanation could be sort of a difference in how critical we are to our own results in different situations. So maybe it is also a human bias that we only sort of double check our results if they're not in line with what we expected in the first place. So if you really expect to find something, it could be the case that you're less likely to double check your results. Whereas if you don't find a significant effect, you might think something went wrong, double check it. And if you actually did make a mistake, you would fix it easier. But there's also been some evidence from some survey research that I think 20% of the surveyed psychologists admitted to at least once in their career having rounded down a p-value to make an effect look significant. So it could also be intentional, but there are several things that could be going on, and we can't really say then.
It's quite shocking to hear that poor statistical practices are so prevalent in science and appear to be occurring almost casually. Because unless the statistics are robust, it's hard to be confident that a result is meaningful. David Spiegelhalter again.
I think the deliberate malpractice, I think, is actually a small percentage of the problems that occur in science. I'm not sure if it's increasing. There's certainly a lot more. What is increasing is the massive amount of published science out there. It's just trough loads of the stuff. So even if the percentage isn't increasing, the absolute amount will be increasing. There is more scrutiny, I think, now. Retraction Watch and other organizations, people are looking at results a lot more carefully. But again, I really don't think that's the big problem. I think the problem is steady exaggeration. In the reproducibility project that was in psychology, okay, it could be argued about how many of the projects were actually false discoveries. Well, what couldn't be argued about is that the average effect found when they reproduced these studies with high power was half of the original claim. So I think there's a very strong suggestion that a large amount of science actually is exaggerated, even if it's not actually wrong, and certainly not fraudulent, it's just exaggerated. And I think that's a really crucial issue.
Even regardless of whether it's sort of intentional malpractice or, like you say, exaggeration, what do you think can now be done? Because like you say, the science output is increasing massively, and so whether or not the percentage is going up and down, as an absolute number, it's going up. And so what kind of checks and balances can we put in place?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely important. Now, there's two issues. There's trying to improve the quality of what's coming out, the flow, and there's trying to improve the amount of ability to call things out, or to critique it, and to vigilance. There's been what's called a reproducibility manifesto come out in Nature. I think it's an excellent document, which points out that this is not a single person's responsibility. There's funders, institutions, the scientists themselves, the journals, all have a responsibility to improve the quality of the stuff that's published. And that means improving peer review. It means improving statistical education, certainly rewarding replication studies, pre-registering studies, you know, so that people cut down the amount of tweaking and twiddling that goes on, and so on. It's no single person's responsibility. But I also do think there's a great need to increase the amount of scrutiny that goes on, that to call things out, not necessarily to say it's got to be retracted. I think it's one of the unfortunate things. There doesn't seem to be anything really between leaving things alone and retracting them. I mean, there are statements that can be made, but I think the lack of ability to comment online on papers is a real shame.
And then just finally, sort of following on that point, how important is it to address these issues? Obviously, within the world of science, for science itself, it's very important, but how important is it when it comes to the relationship between science and the public?
Yeah, I think that this is an incredibly important issue. Science needs to be trustworthy. If science is going to have a voice in society, and you know, there's some suggestion that's increasingly being questioned, large segments of the media and segments of the population having doubts about a lot of science. Well, if science is going to be trusted, then it has to be trustworthy. And that means, you know, getting its own shop in order. So, you know, when I see media reporting the science or misreporting science, I think, well, there is a contribution from the media, and in particular press officers can often be tarting things up too much. But in the end, I think it's a scientist's responsibility to make sure that their work is reported as accurately as they can. So, you know, the statistics and how they're communicated and the strength of evidence, whether we're talking about Higgs boson or detecting extrasensory perception or climate change or vaccines or whatever, any sort of area, statistical evidence is totally vital, and it needs to be trustworthy. And that means acknowledging uncertainty. It doesn't mean overclaiming. It means having appropriate levels of confidence and communicating those.
Special thanks this week to David Spiegelhalter, John Carlisle, and Michelle Noyton. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our new email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.